This is Unhurt Cuts on Being. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Richard Davidson. He's a neuroscientist based at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. I spoke with him on May 24th, 2011, from the studios of APM in St. Paul, Minnesota. He was in the studios of public radio station WPR in Madison, Wisconsin. This interview is included in our show, Investigating Healthy Minds. Download the MP3 of the produced show at onbeing.org.
Can you get me a glass of water?
No possibly? Problem.
Thank you so much. Should I put on the headphones?
Mm-hmm, sure.
Okay.
Get that a little closer to me. Does that work? Okay.
NPR, your guest is here.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Hello?
Hello.
Oh, hi. Do you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, it's Krista Tippett.
Hi, it's Richard Davidson.
Welcome.
Thank you.
I heard that they're getting you some water.
They are.
That's good.
Yes, thank you. How long will this go for?
We'll shoot for an hour. Does that sound all right?
That sounds good.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know you're a busy person. Do you have any questions for me before we start?
I don't think so.
Okay. You've come up so often in my conversations across the years. I've interviewed a lot of people who intersect with your work, Esther Sternberg and Matthieu Ricard, and I don't know. I was thinking there's a whole list of them before I came. I did come up and introduce myself. I don't know if you remember at the Emory event. I was there. I moderated some of those plenary sessions when uh-huh. His Holiness was at Emory and back in the fall.
Right. Yes, I do vaguely remember.
Yeah,
yes.
That's right. So, Chris, how are we doing? Do you need us to do some sound checks?
I have a little more from Mr. Davidson.
Okay. Why don't you tell me something mundane, like what you had for breakfast?
I had my cereal concoction that I usually have.
Oh, tell me. What's in it?
It's actually a porridge that we make with amaranth and millet and barley, and I'm not sure what other grains are in there.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite good.
Do you have it with yogurt or something like that?
I have a sweet tooth, so I had it with delicious Wisconsin organic maple syrup.
Mm, that sounds great. Okay. All right. I think we can go. So let's plunge right in. I want to start where I start with everyone, just to hear, just ask you, was there a religious or spiritual background to your childhood that you grew up with?
Well, I grew up in a Jewish family and went to a Jewish day school for the first 9 years of my education. But I wouldn't really, it certainly wasn't spiritual. And it wasn't particularly religious either, although it certainly had some fringes of religion, but not really with any kind of orthodoxy.
Mm-hmm. So, I've read several accounts where you've talked about or written about how you've had this lifelong conviction that went back to your teenage years, that the mind... Here's one way you said it, underlies all that is important for flourishing and happiness. Mm-hmm. Where did that interest in the mind come from? Do you know?
Well, I actually don't know exactly, although it just seemed to make a lot of sense to me early on in my life that our minds were really crucial to our... how we related to everything around us, and that we actually had an opportunity by altering our minds to alter our realities and the world in which we lived. And I know it sounds a little trite, but that conviction was present really. From high school on, it's something that certainly motivated me in college and subsequently.
But it's interesting to me that you also always were interested in investigating it, thinking about it also in terms of science, right? Or is that true, in terms of biology somehow?
It was. I had a passion for science since I was a kid, and, you know, I was involved in lots of science-related activities. I was a ham radio operator when I was 9 or 10 years old, and built electronic components and volunteered in a sleep laboratory when I was in high school, put on electrodes and cleaned electrodes in the afternoons. I remember very distinctly subscribing to Science News, which is a kind of popular but serious summary of science that comes out each week. And I read it religiously starting in high school. And I used to actually cut out little articles and file them away. And it was just part of my life from very early on.
And then was it your experience of meeting people who meditated, going to India, was that the first time that you made that connection between your interest in the mind and this whole realm of contemplative practice?
It was. It was seeing that there were these people who just seemed like wonderful people. They were really attractive to be around, and they had an interest in common in spirituality and meditation, and that certainly provided the initial impetus for me to explore in this realm.
Mm-hmm. And you've actually put it this way, that it was not until the 90s that you kind of came out of the closet with your interest in actually exploring, pursuing contemplative practice together with science.
That's true, although it was the case that in the early part of my career, toward the end of graduate school and a few years after, I actually published a few papers on meditation. But it was very clear that the times were not right to pursue them. Various senior mentors that I had at that time in the academic arena made it very clear to me that this was not a very good way to begin a career if I wanted a successful career in science. And so while those articles were always on my vita, I never sort of called them out or drew anyone's attention to them. And I think it's fair to say that the vast majority of my scientific colleagues up until the mid-1990s had no idea that I had a strong interest or any interest in this area for that matter.
And by that you mean in this interest in spirituality, meditative practice, contemplative practice?
Yes.
I mean, you know, I did go back and look at a book that you published together with someone else named Davidson in 1980. Was he related to you, Julian?
No. Unrelated.
Okay.
Psychobiology
of Consciousness. And I guess that's when you were still in the closet.
Yeah.
You know, the tone of that is so different. And it starts with, I mean, it was a book you edited. It wasn't all written by you, but it starts with basically an acknowledgement that the relationship of consciousness to biology, that there's little progress has been made. But what's so interesting also to me was it's all about EEG biofeedback, that the tools seem so primitive now. I mean, this wasn't that long ago. It was 1980.
Right, exactly. And that was actually part of my decision to, in fact, not pursue research on the neuroscience of meditation in the early part of my career, because I clearly perceive the tools that were available to us in those days as very coarse and primitive, mm-hmm. and really insufficiently sensitive to capture what I was experiencing as a practitioner. And the last thing I wanted to do was pedestrian research on meditation.
All right. So that's pre-MRI.
Yes, very much pre-MRI. It was actually in many ways pre-neuroscience.
Really?
Well, neuroscience as a identifiable field really started around 1976.
Okay.
That's when I ended graduate school.
And, I mean, it seems to me also that a term that is very common also among lay people in our culture is this idea of being that we're hardwired for things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I would say one of the things, this is just one way I would put it, is that one of the things that you are suggesting in your research over time is that we can also rewire. But was it all, when did science and popular culture start thinking? Was this also around that time about hardwiring, when genetics took some different turns? Has this been a parallel development?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the history of the behavioral sciences and the intersection of behavioral sciences with biology, there are some interesting trends. In the 1960s was the heyday of behaviorism,
yeah,
when the environment was actually emphasized as being the primary cause of our behavior, and there was no attention to the mind and no attention to biology, and the pendulum was very far to the extreme of considering what is inside the head to be really irrelevant. And we begin as a tabula rasa, an empty slate, and the environment through conventional mechanisms of learning determines who we are. And then there were all kinds of questions and problems that were raised with behaviorism, and the cognitive revolution in psychology began to emerge. And around the same time, or perhaps a little afterwards, the role of genetics in behavior became more well-developed and well-characterized, particularly studies simply showing that there's a sizable fraction of our behavior which seems to be under heritable influence.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, I think the pendulum swung in the opposite extreme for quite some time, where everything was attributed to our genes, and there were voices among public intellectuals who were calling into question any programs, for example, to like Head Start and other programs to help disadvantaged individuals, because the claim was that it's all in our genes anyway, and there's nothing much we can do about it.
Right.
That's a bit of a caricature, but it's I think it really does contain the kernel of truth in some of those statements. And I think that what modern neuroscience is teaching us is that in fact there is a lot of plasticity. That change is indeed possible, and that there is a balance of contributions from nature and nurture, and separating them in this rigid way in either of these extremes is probably much too simplistic. But it does seem, I think, that the evidence is more and more strongly in favor of the importance of environmental influences in shaping brain function and structure, and even shaping the expression of our genes. It's not that genes are unimportant, it's just that they're much more dynamic than we previously understood.
So is it right that in 1992 the Dalai Lama sent you a fax inviting you to apply your ideas to study the brains of monks? Is that right?
Yes,
kind of in that category of EEGs,
to come meet with him in India, mm-hmm, and to explore the possibility of using the tools of what then was modern neuroscience to study what might have changed in the brains of these long-term meditation practitioners.
And I mean, you're now known as a pioneer in this field of affective neuroscience, which is now, I think, larger than studying the brains of Olympic meditators, but began with that. I mean, just tell me what that encounter and learning and that study What did that open up for you?
Well, first, the affective neuroscience, just to clarify terms, is a phrase that has been used to describe research on the neuroscience of emotion. Mm-hmm. And there is another hybrid discipline that we're cultivating called contemplative neuroscience,
right,
which is the study of the impact of contemplative practices on the brain. And so I think you're really more referring to the latter, to contemplative neuroscience. I've been very much involved in both of those. But when I met the Dalai Lama for the first time in 1992, that was a meeting that I think is difficult to overestimate in terms of its importance for my career and for my life. The Dalai Lama challenged me at that meeting in a very direct way and said that, you've been using the tools of modern neuroscience to study qualities like depression and anxiety, mm-hmm, and fear and disgust. Why can't you use those same tools to study qualities like kindness and compassion?
Right.
And there really was no good answer to that question other than that the study of kindness and compassion is hard. But it was hard when we began to study fear and anxiety.
Right.
And we've made, as a field, a tremendous amount of progress in understanding the brain mechanisms that underlie those emotional qualities. And so I made a commitment to the Dalai Lama on that day in 1992, and I made a commitment to myself that I was going to do everything I could to put compassion on the scientific map. And indeed, I've really very much reoriented my research from that point on. And the work on these virtuous qualities and on the impact of contemplative practices to cultivate these qualities has assumed a more and more significant chunk of my professional life.
I think you've also noted that whereas science had developed and has developed a very nuanced vocabulary on negative affects like or depression, hostility, that there wasn't even a very sophisticated, there wasn't at all a sophisticated way of talking about or thinking about or analyzing something like compassion.
That's true, and I would say there still isn't a very sophisticated vocabulary. There was a time, and in fact it's still represented in this way in many reviews and textbooks, there was a time when the repertoire of human emotions was described, and it was described as six emotions, all of which are either neutral or negative, and then there's just one positive emotion. And
what was that? Compassion?
No, that was happiness.
Happiness.
That's simple. Yeah, the classic six are happiness, fear, anger, disgust, sadness, and surprise.
Hmm.
Those are the six that have been classically studied as so-called discrete basic emotions. So surprise can be either positive or negative. The others are negative, and then there's one positive emotion. When we talk to the people in the contemplative traditions about this, they just are amazed that that this is the best you can do in Western psychology.
Right. What's your working definition of compassion then at this point?
My working definition of compassion is that it is a motivational state that is associated with the propensity to relieve the suffering of others.
Hmm. But it's also, I think you suggest it's not that it, right, so that it's not just feeling oriented, that it is also has action potential.
Yes, exactly. It's both a feeling quality and an associated action disposition, mm-hmm. as we would say.
I mean, you've also said that very much like language, you think that we're born with a capacity to be compassionate.
I do, and I think it's very similar to the way language is conceptualized as part of our innate repertoire. If it is part of our innate repertoire, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's automatically expressed in any environment. There have been, for example, case studies of feral children who have been raised in the wild in the absence of a linguistic community. And we know that in those children, they actually don't develop a normal capacity for language. And in the same way, I think it is with compassion. I think compassion requires a nurturant community for it to arise, be nourished, be cultivated. And in the absence of that kind of nourishing, supportive early environment, I think even though it is an innate capacity, it can be stifled.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, you know, people often ask, well, if compassion is an innate quality, why does it have to be cultivated? And it's like asking the question, if language is an innate capacity, why is it necessary for us to be raised in a linguistic community?
Right. But the way language gets passed on is, our mother tongues at least, is not so much people telling us about it, but just doing it around us. And then we
I think it's the identical
mm-hmm.
Situation for compassion. The best way to teach compassion is to embody it,
mm-hmm.
not to teach it explicitly, but simply to be it. And it's through the being that the individuals in the vicinity of that person who's exuding compassion will implicitly understand and be affected by it and will learn from it.
So,
and that's what's mm-hmm. what's so delicious about being in the presence of the Dalai Lama.
Right. So I do want to get this connection right between the contemplative neuroscience and the affective neuroscience, because it seems to me, but I want you to correct me if I'm not getting this right, that you learned things from these meditators, which you are then now applying to regular human beings and also to disordered emotions, to some of these negative states. I think the title of your center, the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds, points at the fact that you see this as the cultivation of positive qualities rather than just this focus on eradicating negative qualities. So now nuance what I just said and tell me the tour story.
Well, I think your characterization is quite accurate. We start from the conjecture that health is not simply the absence of illness. And that's true for both mental health as well as physical health.
Mm-hmm.
And so the cultivation of positive qualities doesn't simply mean the elimination of negative qualities. And so that's why the name of our center was very intentionally chosen. And we're interested in what positive qualities constitute a healthy mind. And once those are identified, how can we nurture them so that they become more prominently and more widely expressed in our culture? Those are the central questions which motivate both the basic research as well as the translational research in our center.
And, you know, again, so what you learned from studying the brains of monks and meditators, you learned things about neuroplasticity, which really were very new, right, and exciting for the entire field of neuroscience. I mean, how does that tell me what that is, why that's meaningful, and how that applies to this work you do with other people?
Well, the work with long-term practitioners that we've done, as well as that we're continuing to do, is important because it sort of defines the further reaches of human plasticity and transformation.
Which just means that our brains can change, right? I mean, simply put.
Simply put, yeah, and sort of the further extremes of brain changes. Mm-hmm. And so when we study these experts, we see things in their brain that have not been reported before in human brains.
So like what?
Well, they're sort of technical, if you will, but they for the neuroscience community, they're very meaningful. There is a brain rhythm that is called gamma. Mm-hmm. Oscillations, and gamma oscillations are recorded through the electrical activity of the brain, and they are fast frequency oscillations. They oscillate approximately 40 times per second. And when you observe gamma oscillations in a normal conventional person who has not gone through this kind of training, you see the oscillations for very short periods of time. Typically 1 second or less, and they're associated with specific kinds of learning or perception. They often occur when different elements of a percept are bound together. And so what I mean by that is a lot of our perception involves combining elements from different sensory modalities, mm-hmm. And integrating them together in a unified experience. And those different elements need some mechanism to bind them together, and gamma oscillations are thought to be at least one mechanism through which these different elements are bound together. But that kind of binding occurs very episodically and in a very punctate way in the brain. What we observed in the long-term practitioners during certain kinds of meditation, particularly meditation on compassion, was that these gamma oscillations persisted for a much longer period of time than has ever been reported. They persisted for minutes, mm-hmm. continuously at very high amplitude. And this was just something that had not been observed before.
Do we know how that kind of gamma ray oscillation, how that expresses itself in personality or in life, or how does that
we don't
correlate?
Okay. We don't at this point. Mm-hmm. We know a little bit about what the phenomenological correlates are in these long-term practitioners, mm-hmm. and the clearest phenomenological correlate is a quality of clarity of their perception. Hmm. And so one of the sort of operating intuitions that we have in the long-term practitioners is that they are very good at providing granular accounts of their experience because they spend a lot of time interrogating their own minds. Right. And actually the word meditation in Sanskrit, one of its meanings comes from the word familiarization. And we can think of these individuals as being just utterly familiar in a very deep way with their own mind. Okay. And that familiarization allows them to provide very granular reports. And when they give those reports, it turns out that they could scale the extent to which their experience has this quality of clarity. And that quality of clarity turns out to be very highly correlated with the presence of these gamma oscillations.
Okay.
The more clarity, the more gamma.
Okay. So then back to how these insights, maybe that one sounds kind of mysterious still, but that and other things you learned about neuroplasticity. You're now applying, you're now doing work, I assume applying some of that to with children, with also with affective and anxiety disorders, with things like ADD, with autism, with asthma. So mm-hmm. tell me how what you've learned and all that then changes these approaches, what you're developing here.
Well, one of the things about all of these different conditions that you describe, like ADHD, anxiety disorders, affective disorders, post-traumatic stress disorder, autism, they all involve differences in certain aspects of brain function. And kind of simple-minded idea which motivates this is that we know now that these contemplative practices can change brain function and brain structure. And if that's true, then perhaps we can use these methods, and it's really a family of methods, to change the mind, and through that change the brain in ways that may be beneficial for helping individuals who are suffering from some of these disorders. That's kind of the simple-minded intuition which underlies this. And so we also hope that we can use some of these methods preventatively. And so that is really behind a lot of the work we're doing with kids, because we feel that if we can teach kids to some of these simple strategies, they will have a toolbox from which they can select to help them with adversity that they may encounter as they go along. And so we're actually doing work now starting in preschool with 4- and 5-year-olds to provide them with these kinds of tools, to train them in these ways, and then to follow them over the course of development to see if learning these strategies early in life can make a difference in facilitating a more positive trajectory of development and minimizing deleterious outcomes.
And you've just started those projects, so you don't have a lot of years of data behind them at this point.
Right. We've just started them, but I must say that it's been amazingly gratifying to just anecdotally see their effects. I was in I live in Madison, Wisconsin. It's a kind of a small, closely knit community in many ways, and I was in actually a Trader Joe's not too long ago, and ran into a parent who was a parent of one of the preschool children who is part of our study. And I didn't know this person, but they knew who I was, and they just came over to me and wanted to tell me two things. They wanted to thank me for what we were doing because they've noticed positive changes in their kid, and they also wanted to know where they can learn these methods, because they found that it was clearly so helpful to their child.
And so when you say there's a family of methods, I mean, is some kind of contemplative or meditative practice always involved? And what else? What else is in this family of methods, this toolbox?
Well, the idea here is simply that there are literally hundreds of different kinds of meditation practices.
Yeah.
And so often in the West, we have this idea that meditation is one thing, and that every kind of meditation will produce the same kinds of effects. And that's just simply not true. The contemplative traditions from which we draw have literally hundreds of different kinds of practices, and they are designed for different kinds of people or for a person in different situations. They are understood within their own traditions to produce different effects, and biologically and behaviorally in the laboratory, they produce different effects.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of the way I often talk about it to lay audiences, is that the word meditation is kind of like the word sports. There are many different kinds of sports. They can be performed. Some are more active, some are less active, some are performed in groups, some not. And the same is true of meditation.
It's a big umbrella term.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, so what would you do with young children like that?
Well, with young children, our work is focused on two kinds of practices, two classes of practices. Within each class, there are a number of different types of practice, but the two classes are, one is designed to cultivate kindness, and the other is designed to cultivate mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And by mindfulness here, we mean moment-by-moment non-judgmental attention or awareness.
Okay. And kind of attention and self-awareness, right? And it was since leading to kind of a kind of self-regulation.
Self-awareness, but also other awareness. So not just self-awareness, but certainly self-awareness would be included, including awareness of what's going on in one's body, which can be very helpful in understanding what emotions you're experiencing, but also very much focused on other, being aware of others, being aware of one's environment. You know, there are meditations on sound that are done to help children learn to pay attention to not just the inside, but the outside as well.
And what about the kindness? How do you cultivate that?
Well, you know, it's cultivating that in children is a very, we use very different approaches than we do with adults. There are a lot of props that are used. There are books that we use as external props. There are opportunities for sharing, actual opportunities, as well as more classical mental kinds of training, where the children envision other kids in their classroom and envision times when they may have been not feeling so good, and generating the wish to help help them be happier. And help relieve their suffering.
You're teaching them to be reflective. I mean, right, that would be one way to talk about what's going on in both of those instances with mindfulness and kindness.
Yes, there's definitely a reflective piece in each. Absolutely.
I mean, I know you're also working with adolescents, which is very interesting, and I would think that then the methods would be different. I mean, that's a tumultuous time for the human brain and mind, isn't it? I mean, so how do you adapt this?
Yeah, those are all wonderful questions. And, you know, this is a stage where I think we and others need to do a lot of tinkering and to figure out exactly what may work best. But also, I quickly add that I don't think there's any one strategy which is going to work best for all individuals. I don't think one size is going to fit all. And I think that one of the goals of this kind of scientific work is to better match specific individual differences in cognitive and emotional style, if you will, with strategies that are maximally effective for that person. That's one of the thrusts of some of the research that we do today.
My daughter, when she was 12 or 13, did some science project at school on the adolescent brain. And she learned how difficult it was to be. This gave her great excuses for a while when she was being emotional, impulsive, that she couldn't help it because she had an adolescent brain.
That's good. Well, that's, you know, it's probably true. How old is she now?
Well, now she's 17, and actually I think her brain is in a much better place at this point.
Well, there's, you know, the dilemma of adolescence is that puberty is occurring earlier and earlier, yet the rate at which our regulatory systems in the brain mature has remained the same for thousands of years. And so we actually have a longer period in human history today than we've ever had between the onset of puberty and the onset of the full maturation of regulatory systems in the brain.
So it's not just that it starts earlier, it lasts longer.
Yes. It lasts much longer.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, we now have like a 10-year period is longer than ever before in human history.
Hmm. So, you know, I know that you've been honored by the American Psychological Association, and I wonder, how does your work inform the work of psychotherapy? Are you learning things about actually changing the brain, about influencing the mind and influencing ourselves biologically with behaviors that might, I don't know, circumvent, transcend, or somehow enrich the ways we already know to work with who we are and how healthy we are and how we live?
Well, you know, I'd like to believe that some of the work that we do may have some implications or relevance for kind of on the ground, in the trenches, psychotherapy or related strategies for behavior change in several ways. One is a kind of meta level, which helps a client or patient understand that based upon everything we know about the brain and neuroscience, that change is not only possible, but change is actually the rule rather than the exception. Mm. And it's really just a question of which influences we're gonna choose for our brain. But our brain is wittingly or unwittingly being continuously shaped,
right,
by events around us, and we can take more responsibility for our own brain by cultivating certain more positive kinds of influences. So that's one thing that I think at a meta level could potentially be helpful. Another thing, there are three things here. Another thing is the idea of practice. The classical model of Western psychotherapy, which is, you know, a client coming to a therapist for an hour a week for,
right,
you know, a 50-minute session without doing daily practice in between, just is, you know, flies in the face of everything we know about the brain and plasticity.
That's really interesting, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
So if we want to make real change, that's not a good prescription for doing it.
Mm-hmm.
If we want to make real change, more systematic practice is necessary, in my view. And this is something that comes directly from neuroscience. And I think that certain kinds of psychological therapies are now understanding that. And so certain kinds of cognitive therapies, for example, do assign specific kinds of homework or practice for people to engage in on a daily basis. So I think there's growing recognition of that.
And again, the different focus that you're taking that we talked about at the beginning, the focus that was different for scientists, but also the focus that's different from, I think, psychology, psychotherapy, that it's focused on what's wrong and addressing that. You're also. I mean, the practice would be about cultivating positive qualities, right? Not just remembering, recalling, delving into pain, alone.
Right. I think that's very important, and I think that most people still don't think of qualities like happiness as being a skill.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than it's typically conceptualized as a fixed trait, and some people have more of it, some people have less of it. But if you think about it more as a skill, then it's something that can be enhanced through training. Fundamentally, I think that the kind of mental exercise that we're talking about is no different than physical exercise.
Right.
And people understand that they can't just do 2 weeks of physical exercise and then expect
healthy.
The benefits to remain for the rest of their lives. And the same thing with mental exercise.
I was also thinking about you know, when you talked earlier on that there were six emotional states and one of them was happiness. But mm-hmm. I think about a conversation I had with Mathieu Ricard, who's one of the people whose brains you've studied and who I think you learned a lot from. He talks about happiness, in fact, as a mental state that can precisely take in all emotions and experiences, including negative experiences, but can... It's how you live with those, not a feeling that you have all the time.
Right, right. And I think that that's a very different conception of happiness, one that is a more enduring and I think more genuine in the sense that it's a kind of happiness that is not dependent on external circumstances.
Right, right. That can take in all whatever comes at you.
Right,
whatever circumstances.
Absolutely.
I wonder how your definition, or not just your definition, your imagination about contemplative practice has expanded over the years. I know that I was listening into a symposium you had with about contemplative neuroscience with people from Abrahamic traditions. I also heard you talking about an event in India that you'd gone to where the Dalai Lama had called together people from different Indian spiritual traditions. I think what interests me is clearly there are contemplative strains that run through all the traditions. I'd be interested in interesting differences that you've encountered.
Well, I think that first let me say that the Dalai Lama has been very encouraging of us to... expand the circles of contemplative traditions that we interact with because of his belief that these kinds of questions and this kind of research is potentially applicable to all religious traditions that have a contemplative strand or a contemplative component. In the settings that you described, we've been actively trying to do that. But one of the attractions, I think, of scientists to Buddhism, which is why most of this work, I think, has focused on practices in the Buddhist tradition, certainly not exclusively, but predominantly, is because in the Buddhist tradition, there is a tremendously rich detail in the description of the mechanics of these practices and their putative effects. Much more to sink one's teeth into in some sense. Mm-hmm. But it's also the case that I think that I've heard all kinds of interesting descriptions from other contemplative traditions, and I think that there is opportunity with a number of them, and I think that over the next few years, we will see an increasing number of scientific studies that are conducted on practices from contemplative traditions that come from other traditions beyond Buddhism.
Some people have studied the brains of monks, Christian nuns and monks, I believe. Have you done that, or were those other
we
people?
Have not. Mm-hmm. We have not. Mm-hmm. No, and there's a little bit of work of that sort, but not a lot.
Okay. I moderated a conversation between the Dalai Lama and three religious leaders at a gathering at Emory University that you also participated in something at that. It was the chief rabbi of Great Britain, the head of the Episcopal Church, and the Muslim scholar, Syed Hossein Nasser. Something that I think comes up in conversations with between Buddhist thinkers and, say, people in these Abrahamic traditions, there's more of an emphasis on the body. It's kind of a creative tension, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember listening in on the Abrahamic session that you had, people wanting to talk about what it means to be in a human body, human embodiment. Just wonder how you think about that, and if your sense of that, of the body mind, and the importance of the body per se, has shifted over time.
Well, It's a very interesting question. My understanding of the quality of embodiment and the role that the body might play in contemplative practices, but more generally in influencing the mind and the brain, has certainly expanded over the years. And I would say it's largely expanded not so much through my contact with any contemplative traditions, but really through progress in our scientific understanding. There is a very vibrant research field in the biobehavioral sciences today on embodied cognition and embodied emotion. And what's meant by that is primarily looking at the influence of body states on different kinds of mental processes.
So, what would be an example of that?
What would be an example is for a person's facial expression or posture influencing their language, literally.
Right.
Their propensity for certain kinds of emotional language.
Interesting.
We did a study that we were part of very recently where we studied individuals who received cosmetic Botox injections.
I've heard about this, yeah.
And that selectively paralyzes certain facial muscles. Based upon our understanding of embodiment, if the facial muscles are inactivated, and if embodiment ideas are really true, then this should actually have an impact on modulating the mind and the brain in ways that will affect certain kinds of mental processes. And what we found is that it indeed does affect one's emotional language and the ability to recognize certain emotional elements in language and producing certain emotional elements in language. It's very clear that...
in this case, specifically, that would be you can't furrow your brow, right? You can't frown.
Right.
That has
exactly.
an effect on you emotionally.
Yes. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It does.
But I think...
So I think that just this work... underscores the importance of considering the body, and that's true for certain contemplative practices. It's not an accident that most contemplative traditions emphasize the importance of having an erect posture when one is practicing.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm saying is a little bit different, maybe not completely unrelated to that, but as you say... these contemplative, meditative, especially Buddhism in particular, this has emphasized over thousands of years investigating the mind. Whereas, for example, let's just take the Hebrew Bible, which is very much about human beings as embodied creatures, about physical realities and relationships and flaws and pleasures as forming the mind and the spirit and the life. Right? So it's a different emphasis.
Yes, different emphasis.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I think that's an important vantage point, but I would say that it's the way you're describing it, I think, is a bit of a caricature of Buddhism because certainly it's not just about the mind, and a lot of suffering actually comes from. Mm-hmm. Craving and aversion, which really has a lot to do with the body, but you know that may be part of the point you're making. I think that those are interesting ideas, which deserve to be unpacked.
Yeah, I guess what I absolutely that it's, it. I don't mean it to be a caricature, but I think that. Maybe what I'm also pointing at is the limits. I'm wondering about the limits of applying the experience of these meditative practitioners who have actually gained incredible control, self-regulation in a way, to human lives that are very embodied and messy, right? It's like 21st century lives in the world.
Well, I think that, you know, the messiness and the embodied nature of modern life just provides, you know, an enhanced signal for our attention in some sense. Mm-hmm. I think that it's quite possible to use the opportunities that present themselves in our modern world as vehicles and prompts for the continued development of kindness and compassion and equanimity. Mm-hmm. You know, I lead a very large lab and center, and you know, in many ways, my life has objective signs of extraordinary busyness and stress.
Right.
But you know, in my better moments, I'm able to use that as, you know, this is a wonderful opportunity for this all to be part of the practice.
Right.
It just creates more opportunities for kindness and compassion. It creates more opportunities maintaining one's equanimity. And if you're able to do it in that kind of environment, you know, in less challenging environments, it should be even easier.
Right. I want to ask you this question as a person, as a human being, as much as a scientist. I mean, as you have grown older, you know, how does the experience of aging change the questions you might be asking or how you take in some of the things you're learning in the laboratory?
Well, you know, the experience of aging has been, for me, a very positive one, and it has been one that has, I think, helped to focus and refine my activities and interests. And I feel more and more focused on the importance of continuing this work and continuing to do what I can to nurture this work in other places, because I feel that it has the potential of really making a contribution to human betterment. And so I've gotten less interested in some of the more arcane peripheral questions, yeah, which may have been more interesting to me 10 years ago. I think my priorities have gotten clearer.
I wonder when you know, we talked about a book you wrote about the psychobiology of consciousness back in 1980. The distinction, I'm curious about the distinction you make between these terms, brain, mind, consciousness, and if that has changed over time.
Oh, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
It's a tough one for so many reasons. You know, putting on my scientific hat, certainly the view of mainstream modern neuroscience is that the mind and consciousness are somehow emergent properties of the brain. Many philosophers refer to this as the hard problem because we still have no idea how the subjective qualia of consciousness actually emerge from the physical stuff of the brain. And so many of us, myself included, bracket that problem.
Mm-hmm.
We still can make progress on lots of other things without having to solve that problem. But I also straddle a number of different worlds, and I spend quite a bit of time with the Dalai Lama, who has a very different view of mind and brain and consciousness.
Right.
And has the view that at least in some residual form, consciousness can exist without the brain. It may still be some form of energetic matter yet to be understood and determined, but not the, you know, not the brain as we conventionally understand it. And, you know, the honest truth is I have no idea what to do with those kinds of suggestions other than to practice remaining agnostic and distinguishing between what is hard-nosed scientific fact and what is simply part of our conventional scientific dogma or hegemony.
Right.
And the Dalai Lama, in the beginning of his book on science and spirituality, the book entitled The Universe in a Single Atom, says that if there's any tenet of Buddhism which is directly contradicted by scientific fact, that he's prepared to give that up. But he makes a very clear distinction between scientific fact and scientific assumption.
Right.
And so, but it takes a lot of active work to remain in the ambiguity of not knowing.
Right. I mean, you use terms when you speak and write about your work that have that are terms that also occur in theological and philosophical realms. You know, free will, transformation. Do you use the term spiritual technology, or, you know, are you familiar with that term? Is that something you might, a way you might talk about some of these tools and practices that you're using?
Potentially. I don't think I've used that phrase, spiritual technology, but certainly I have talked about range of practices, really the mechanics of practice that are so richly described in some of the contemplative traditions, and the potential value that many of these practices might have for modern science and our modern understanding of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I certainly, the idea of transformation is one that to me meshes perfectly well with conventional scientific understanding. I have no problem with that, you know, I think that that really is a natural byproduct of understanding many of these constructs as the product of skills that can be enhanced through training.
But, you know, so just to that point, I mean, it occurs to me that the name of your center is the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds, but really these skills are skills for healthy lives, right? I mean, you're actually talking about cultivating virtue.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. We are definitely talking about healthy lives, it could have been called the Center for Investigating Healthy Lives.
Would that have felt less scientific, though? Maybe.
Well, you know, I think the key to a healthy life is having a healthy mind.
Mm. This is just my last question. I wonder how what you've learned, discovered, what you know as a scientist, you know, again, kind of across time, I mean, how has that opened up your larger sense of what it means to be human? Maybe what new questions has it given you to work with?
Well, I think that it has... first of all, my scientific work has reinforced and strengthened my personal commitment to my daily practice, where, you know, I, in whatever meager way I can, in my limited practice and experience, help to cultivate these qualities in myself, because I see what a positive influence they can have for others around me, and that the best way I can mentor and lead those around me is to embody these qualities myself.
So when you say practice, you're not just talking about a meditative practice, but practices of living.
Yes, both formal and informal practice. So part of it is a formal meditation practice on the cushion every day. And part of it is also a quality of remembering and trying to bring to every encounter with another person that that's an opportunity. Expressing gratitude and kindness in each of those moments out in the world.
So again, if you, you know, how you thought about what it meant to be human back in the 60s, 70s when you started doing this, how has this opened that, changed that for you?
Yeah, it's given me, I think, a much, I feel a much richer and more encompassing a sense of what it means to be human. I think that it has underscored for me the preciousness of every human encounter. I think that, you know, there was a time in my life where I took a lot more for granted, I do my best to address each moment as that kind of precious opportunity. So my sense of being human, I think, has been really dramatically expanded. And at the same time, I think, you know, my sense of time has in certain ways really slowed down so that I can stop and look at each moment and appreciate it for what it might afford. Rather than sort of rushing on to the next thing.
I remember talking to Jon Kabat-Zinn about that, which is a very striking statement to make in 21st century ears, that by paying attention in a moment, you actually slow down time.
Yeah, I think you radically slow down time. And I think that, you know, one of the experiences that I think you have in meditation is the direct experience of time really slowing down, because you can notice more things per discrete moment, because you're just more open. And I think that leads to a subjective sense of time really slowing down.
Okay. Yes, just I have a question from behind the glass. Okay. Okay. So we actually, I guess they were my producers were tweeting this behind the glass. And someone asked on Twitter what the consequences of this practice can be for this, for multitasking, this kind of way we live now.
Well, you know, one question is whether we actually ever are truly multitasking in the sense of literally doing two things simultaneously, or whether we are rapidly oscillating between the things that we are doing when we're multitasking. But the larger issue, I think, is really just being present with whatever it is that we're doing. So if what we're doing is multitasking,
right,
you know, being present with the multiple tasks that are before us. You know, I have a wonderful picture of Mathieu Ricard. When he comes to Madison, he stays at our house, and he was sitting in the living room with a laptop computer on his lap, looking at the computer, and he was talking on his cell phone, he also had a book right next to him,
right,
open, and it was
this Tibetan,
you know, this
Buddhist monk.
Yes, this wonderful picture of this Tibetan Buddhist monk who is, you know, our digital monk, engaged in multitasking, but you know, I think doing it in a way which was really quite present to all of the various tasks in which he was engaged. So that may not be a very satisfying answer, but I do think it's possible. I've seen it in others. I've seen Matthieu do it. I've seen the Dalai Lama do it.
I think that's very hopeful. like the idea of neuroplasticity itself. All right. Thank you so much, Richard Davidson.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Okay. We'll let you know what's happening with this, too.
Okay, great.
Okay. All right. Take care.
Thanks. Bye.